Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Alpahoff is one of those people I'd heard about for a long time, and I even interviewed her over Zoom a couple of years ago. But in early September, I finally met her in real life for the first time. She is, bar none, one of the coolest people working in the business, so I immediately begged her to come on the podcast. So she's Chief Production Officer for Himbrimi Gin, which is made from Iceland's geothermal waters, and it has Arctic botanicals in it. So I was going to use this conversation to talk to Alba about what it's like to distill gin, but I got so carried away with the conversation that we never got around to it. When you listen, you'll understand why. Suffice it to say that the gin is amazing. It's like nothing you've ever tasted. And if you're into gin, you've got to grab a bottle. Okay, back to Alba. She's also president of the Icelandic Sommelier Association and is on the diversity committee for the AASI, which is the International Association of Sommeliers. In this conversation, we talked about everything from the wine market in Iceland to its historic and evolving food culture, to what it's like to go grave digging in summer, and the traditional way to preserve fish. If you want the takeaways, sign up for the newsletter at drinksinsider.com or drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. Alba, so great to see you again.
Thanks, Felicity. So great to be here.
Right. Let's start by talking about your wine career. How did you get into wine?
Actually, by accident. I studied classical service in my late teens. Went to the Culinary Institute here and did both practical and theory. And then when you graduate, you graduate as a professional waiter, basically. So that was going to be my life. I just wanted to be in hospitality. And at the time, especially in Iceland, wine wasn't really prevalent. It was still a fairly new kind of concept because we're not a wine-producing country. And so all the questions I had, I was getting different answers from various people. Just basic things like what is the difference between a Merlot and a Cabernet, and no one would have the same answer. So I decided it might be best to just do it myself. And so I studied.
Where did you get the wines from? Because I imagine that was quite difficult.
Yes and no. The thing is, here we have a monopoly. So we have a wide variety, especially these days, of distributors that bring in wines from all over the world. And because our alcohol tax is so high, unfortunately, it's mildly painful buying a bottle of wine. But what it does, on the other hand, is that anything that is entry level will cost almost the same when it finally gets to the country as somewhere into the mid ranges. So technically, we do get a higher quality of quality category of wines into the country than mainland Europe, for instance.
That is so interesting.
It is. It's harder when you're moving into spirits, because that's when it really starts to be painful.
All right. So you got into wine, and then what happened once you'd started answering the questions like what's the difference between Merlot and Cabernet? What happened next?
I mean, like with anything else, the more you study, the more you realize how stupid you actually are. So I just kept on.
You're talking to the person who is just profoundly ignorant, I've realized.
I know, right? I always feel like I'm the idiot in the room, but you know, that is also a privileged place to be, so that's fair enough. But yeah, I just kept studying, and I was actually, an old boss of mine registered my name into a competition here and didn't tell me on purpose. And then a few days before the competition, he pulled rank and said, "I'm not asking you to compete, I'm telling you to compete."
That's
and, you know,
funny.
Me being the good soldier that I am, I did. And what played out after that was my first international competition.
Hang on a second. That first competition, yeah. I mean, did you train or did you just stumble through it? What happened?
No, I did. I panic trained. I panic trained with like 4 days in advance, but
4 days. You trained for 4 days. What did your training consist of in 4 days?
Practical, mostly, because, I mean, you're not studying in 4 days. It's either you know stuff or you don't, so nothing's going to happen.
But so did you make all your family and friends sit down so you could pour them wines? And
no, I made my boss do it. He's the one that put me in the situation. No, and I was lucky enough to work with colleagues that did have some sort of history in competition. At least they'd competed once or twice and seen it happen. So I got really great tips there. But competitions then, I mean, 20 years ago, they're not the same thing as they are now. It's a completely different beast. So I did. There was a lot of opening of sparkling wine and champagne. There was a lot of decantation going on. There was, you know, a lot of shaking hands and clinking somewhere, but it worked.
Did you find it stressful standing on stage for the first time?
Yeah, I was mad. I almost passed out. And remember, this was not my choice. I never wanted to stand in front of people and talk about things that I don't know enough about. That was not my idea of a good party.
Oh, that's so funny. Okay, so after that happened, how did your boss react to your competition? Was it, yay, have a bottle of champagne? Or was it like, oh, I've now got this next task?
It was more like, I told you so.
Right.
But I mean, he's a great, great friend of mine today. And because of this decision, however uncomfortable it was, it did mold my competition career and just the rest of my career, actually. So
talk about what you did next.
Next was just a big leap, just into the big leagues, actually. My first international competition was just a few months later for the Trophée Rinard, which was the European competition at the time and was actually the last Trophée Rinard competition that was held before the European competition got assembled into the ASI, so the International Sommelier Association.
And what was that like, going from a local competition to suddenly an international one?
It's traumatizing. And especially, I mean, I had a mohawk at the time, Felicity. Shit got real, real fast. And I remember, I mean, it was held, of course, in the Champagne region. And we were...
with Paris. A mohawk.
I did, you know, in my little penguin suit with my little apron. It was adorable and scary at the same time. And I remember the press were all over me because, I mean, who has a mohawk in fine dining? And one of these guys, he was quite serious. He was intrigued and quite serious. He's like, why do you find that your hair is has any sort of negative effect on your performance? And I looked at him and it was in all sincerity. I just didn't understand what he was getting at. I was like, how does my hair physically affect what I do or my olfactory system?
Yeah, that's right. Through the roots of the hair.
I knew what he was getting at, but it was just such a preposterous kind of question, you know. But people that I competed with then are some of my oldest and dearest friends till today.
And so once you get into the world, explain the world of smellier competitions a bit. Once you get in on the circuit, does that mean that you end up going from place to place for the next few years? And how do you fund the travel?
I mean, well, to be able to travel internationally on a regular basis for a competition, you need to win the local competition. So I did that for a decade and had the opportunity to go to the Europeans.
So they pay the travel for the next thing?
The Sommelier Association pays for the travel.
Right.
Yeah. And then the hosting country or the hosting organization will generally pay for your accommodation. So you're not really forking out that much. I would never, in my wildest dreams, have been able to afford half the places I've stayed in. It really is quite the privilege. I feel like a proper princess.
So for people outside Europe who know nothing about the competition circuit, how much can you talk about how much preparation you have to do once you start getting to that level? How much of your life does it take up, and what sort of preparation do you do?
I mean, it's sacrifice, first and foremost. It takes up all of your time. And I mean, depending on where you are in the world, first and foremost, and where you are in your competition career, some people still do have to work 300 hours a month because we're still hospitality. We're in service, right? Let alone the individuals that own their own businesses. In other cases, there's a little bit more leeway depending on the weight and the reach of the local sommelier association, but it just really varies. But there's a lot of sacrifice. There's a lot of hours that go into it, and mainly in just brutal studying. Because studying for a competition is not the same as studying for an exam, right? So examinations, anything to do with, you know, education is based on material that you study in order to understand what you're being taught and to be able to realize that at the end of term or at the end of an exam. Competition study, it's not designed for that. It's designed to weed out everyone that can't hack it. So it's a completely different type of examination. And they are brutal.
Yeah, I remember, you know, speaking to sommeliers to tell me that they have to study a lot of maps. Tell me about that. Why do you have to do that?
Well, I mean, geography is key to wine. If you don't know your geography, you're not passing any exams anyway. So that's applicable to everything when it comes to viticulture and wine production and so on. You need your geography. And a lot of history plays into that as well, because legal categories of wine, they're based in regions, they're based on areas, they're based on their history. So that's key. Geography is always key.
It's interesting. All right. So, how far did you go in the sommelier competitions?
Well, I didn't win, so.
What? All that study, all that trauma.
All for nothing. No, I never got to the semifinals. There was once or twice when I think I came close to it, but one never knows. But what I did gain, on the other hand, aside from the experience of competition, you know, on its own, is that the ability and a little bit of know-how to train forward. So for those who are now competing for the Icelandic team, it's a bit easier to divulge what sort of information, what sort of training techniques and so on. So that's one. And the most important thing is the relationships that I've gained and held on to. Anywhere in the world, there's a contact, there's a couch somewhere.
Yes.
Or, you know, there's a glass of something somewhere.
Now, you're now the president of the Iceland Sommeliers Association. So what sort of issues do you deal with?
Funding? No, we're very small. So Iceland is a nation of 370,000 people.
And you're all related to Bjork?
Yes, they are. Technically, my genes are the healthiest in the country. So it's DNA speaking, not technically Icelandic. But the rest of them, yes, are absolutely all related to Bjork.
Right, I'm sorry. So I interrupted you. So it's a very small association. Go on.
Yeah, we're very small. And because we're so small and because of our monopoly system, we can't technically have sponsors within the wine world.
Right.
Because it's just too much of a conflict of interest. So two of my board members are sommeliers, but they're also working for distributors. So you can just imagine if random distributors are sponsoring the association, there's always going to be a conflict of interest, and that always gets messy, and that's just not my style. So we fund it with doing annual tastings for the monopoly and so on. But it's always an issue. Funding is always key.
And do you have a good relationship with Monopoly? I mean, do they offer any help?
Well, no. Technically, the monopoly is run by the government, so there's no help from them. That's not the issue. The way we set it up is it's a tasting of wines within a certain price category that are sold in the monopoly, but they are that middle-priced category. So anything that's cheaper is going to move automatically because, you know, it's cheap and accessible. Anything weightier in price are already categories that people know and they're buying on purpose because of the prestige. But it's that middle category of lovely wines that can be found for, you know, fairly honest prices compared to Icelandic prices, if you know where to look. But that category never gets any limelight. So those are the wines that we generally taste. So it's a blind tasting, and then the top 15 wines out of, you know, some hundreds, they get like a golden glass stamp on it. We recommend, our blind tasters recommend this, this, and this, and that's how they sell in the monopoly.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about Iceland's wine scene. Can you talk about Give me the overview. It is a very small country, but you have millions of tourists. So how has that led to the development of the wine scene?
Well, the tourists have had less of an impact on the wine scene per se. Yes, we do have around 2 million tourists per year, which is mad. But Iceland, because we're so isolated, so we're a tiny island in the middle of the North Atlantic, just getting off the island costs an arm and a leg. But we do travel quite a bit because it's the only way to see the sun properly. So we go all over the world. And what we lack in production here, we make up with a very firm idea of what we do and what we do not like, which is key.
Okay, so tell me about that.
I mean, it changes. I mean, like everything, there's an ebb and flow to whatever's in fashion per se. But when we properly got into the idea of consuming wine as part of a meal, everything changed, because anything before that was a bit taboo. So take into consideration that in 1989, beer was first legal.
What?
But you could drink. Yeah, I can't make this shit up.
Really? So what did people drink before then, or was it just a completely dry
spirits.
Country? Spirits, right.
Spirits. Because beer was evil, but spirits was fine.
That is so interesting. Spirits, which are very high ABV, were considered better than beer. Do you know historically why?
Well, there are a few reasons why. So first and foremost, we can produce spirits here. We can't really produce, especially then, we didn't produce beer. Because, I mean, we have very limited resources when it comes to growing things unless it's in greenhouses. And again, today in 2024 is vastly different than it was back in the 80s, for instance. Right? So, because beer was consumed, just generally consumed all around the world as an average go-to kind of beverage. If you look at the Danes, I mean, they have several a day and so on. So the stigma behind that was that if you're drinking in the middle of the week, then you must be an alcoholic. However, if you were binge drinking during the weekend, well, that was just natural.
That's so interesting.
So we've come such a long way since then.
And when did wine culture get introduced, and how did it get introduced?
I mean, proper wine culture as in relation to food and wine, that was in the early 2000s, realistically. So it was creeping up on us in the late 90s and then in the early 2000s. I remember pairing my first 5-course menu and having a conversation with a guest that looked at me like I was mad. I expected him to drink 5 different types of wine with the same food, because, I mean, that was just preposterous. But it was funny to have half a bottle of vodka on the side.
So people did drink spirits with meals.
It's not common per se, but it felt more natural to some people than having 5 different wines.
Did you convince the guy to try the wines?
Oh yeah, I bribed him. I bribed him. It was basically, please, just try it my way. Try it this way. If you're not into it, fine, I'll take the cost and you get your beer and, you know, no love lost.
And how did he react? Did he like it?
Thankfully he did. I would have gone bankrupt, personally, if that were the case. But you needed to ease people into it. But then as soon as something catches on, it catches on. And the rest is history. So wine with food is it's common practice. It's now a thing, even if we're not a wine-producing country. So no one bats an eye at it. And we do like our various fads. I mean, like I said, it's always an ebb and flow, whether it's Valpolicella that's in fashion, or Chianti that's always stable. Burgundy is never going to go anywhere. Like the rest of the Nordics these days, in the last few years, there has been a great influx of natural wines. But it comes and goes.
So tell me, something I've been wondering about is when wine gets introduced, especially into spirits-heavy cultures, do you think that the introduction of wine is just an add-on, or does it help to moderate the quite unhealthy drinking patterns that often come with spirits cultures?
It definitely changes things. Just by introducing a different point of view of how to consume definitely changes things. And we, the Sommelier Association, we do advocate as fiercely as we can for responsible consumption and moderate consumption. You know, quality, not quantity, and so on. So you can see a difference. But I mean, at the end of the day, like anywhere else in the world, if people are hell-bent on consuming, they're just going to do that.
Yeah. Okay. So now Iceland has got a really interesting food culture. Can you talk about that in its historic context?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's actually quite special. So we're a colony, first and foremost, right? The first settlers come over from Norway, and then we're a Danish colony for quite a while, which means that not only were we dependent on our colonizer, but because it's such a strange landscape here, I mean, it's a volcanic island. Everything, mm-hmm. we have rock and we have ice and a little bit more of each, right? So agriculture really isn't a thing, unless we're talking sheep. There are more sheep in Iceland than there are people. Is it 2 sheep for every person?
How do you tell the landscape? How do you tell your country apart from New Zealand? You could be describing New Zealand.
I mean, you can, but
because there's actually, more grass in New Zealand.
You can tell. There's no vegetation.
But yeah, okay. So you've got sheep and you've got nothing else. So how do you build a food culture around that?
There's a lot of smoking. There's a lot of curing, freezing, obviously, but that doesn't work all around. There's a lot of acidic food, and there are some horror stories about how things used to be preserved back in the day.
Go on, give me a horror story.
I know, but they're so bad. Okay, so well, smoking is a primary method, and it, I mean, especially lamb and fish, things become absolutely magnificent. But one old method is putrefaction.
Ew.
Right. So, oh, this is going to sound so bad. There are two
go
types.
Go on, tell
food.
The story.
I know, man. There are two types of food. So one is shark. So putrefied shark is possibly the most horrendous thing on the planet, because not only do you need to hang it and dry it and actually create the putrefaction process, but when you finally do taste it, the meat itself is almost cheese-like, almost like like a spongy cheese. It's quite weird, but it's so potent in its smell that we only feed this stuff to tourists. It's hilarious. We don't actually eat this. I mean, aside from a farmer here and there, yeah. But it's very old school. And there's nothing wrong with it, but it did keep the fish edible, right? Another example is skate. So we are a fishing nation, first and foremost. And most of our fish would go to Denmark or, you know, go for sales. And the least of it would be consumed by the locals, right? So all through the year, if you had skate in the nets, you'd bring it back to land and you'd shove it in a hut, right? In order for that skate to keep somewhat, you needed to add ammonia to it, right? So imagine 300 years ago, where are you going to get your ammonia?
Yeah, yeah. Where are you going to get your ammonia? Yeah,
so we have a rich old culture of pissing on fish. But the thing is, I mean, here's where it's key. The reason why that was done is that because you need to keep it all year round, right? And, you know, freezing is just not enough if it's going through the summer months. Because in late December, on December 23rd, when everybody finally came back to land for Christmas,
Hang on, where were they before? They were just off on boats?
At sea.
Right, okay.
And also when all the fishermen would come back to land for Christmas, that would be their bonus. That's what they would have on the 23rd of December for dinner. I can't make this up. And we still have this tradition, given we no longer urinate on our room. There are different methods.
Right? Are there old-timers who miss the old ways? Who go, I remember when we used to get together and piss on the fish. I'm really sorry that's gone.
I mean, I'm sure it was a very camaraderie-filled experience, but I don't think even the oldest of our old-timers actually remember pissing on fish. It might be a little older than that, but I can neither confirm nor deny.
It's always interesting to know where these these things come from and how they develop and then how they disappear. Like if you go to old Roman ruins, they had public toilets, meaning you all went to the toilet in the same room together. I'm just like, and then it died out as a tradition, and I always wonder why.
I wonder why that happened.
Yeah. Okay. So that's an interesting food culture. So I'm guessing that, like everywhere else, it changed once the price of flights went and everybody started to travel and see what everybody else is doing. So describe the food culture today.
I mean, the food culture is still very rich with local produce. So lamb is staple, fish is staple. We are so spoiled when it comes to raw produce. I mean, aside from vegetables, which we do grow in abundance in greenhouses because, again, we're very spoiled with electricity. But we're a very meat-forward nation, very meat and potatoes.
Not a good place for vegetarians.
I mean, we have them. we have them. No, but when it comes to the food scene, we've turned into quite a foodie spot. And unlike many countries, is that anyone who walks into a restaurant will be greeted with the options for vegetarian or vegan or gluten-free or whatever. It is, you accommodate everything. It's not something that would surprise anyone. As opposed to if you go to any of the major cities in Europe, they'll look at you all funny if you say you're a vegan, which is unnecessary. Not that I am, but it is still unnecessary.
I haven't been to Iceland, which I'm planning to correct sometime.
Scandalous.
But it is scandalous. That's terrible. But one of the things that really strikes me about the Nordics in general is how much more modern they are compared to the rest of Europe. Like they're all early adopter cultures and, digitalization works, which it doesn't in Central Europe. it doesn't. All right. So imagine that, well, don't imagine, many people listening to this podcast are wine producers looking for export markets. How do they get into a market like Iceland, and what sort of wines succeed and which don't?
I mean, that really depends. The staple wines, the most commercially accessible regions, not wines per se, but the commercially accessible areas that everybody knows, usually do move quite well. Anything with Italy, we are great lovers of Ribera and Rioja. Austrian wines are catching on more and more. It's an ebb and flow. And if you want to penetrate the market, I mean, first and foremost, you do need a distributor. But our distributors travel quite a bit. They are very open to new product. But the main issue is being a tender in the monopoly, because that's what moves.
So you have to get a tender from the monopoly to be able to be listed. So how does it work? Do you wait for a tender for the monopoly and then the distributors go looking for something that fits that, or can you work with a distributor and just hope that a tender opens up? And can you work with a distributor for the on-trade?
Both can apply, but there are many distributors that have wines that are not part of the monopoly and are only reserved for restaurants.
Right, so you
all
can
of
do
the above. Is
you
applicable.
Can do that. You can get into the markets through the on trade if you don't get a tender.
Precisely.
Okay.
It's not going to move in volume, but it absolutely is possible.
And so, where do people buy? People can only buy in restaurants and wine bars, and they can only buy at government shops. Is that right?
We have a loophole in our laws.
Oh, loophole. Okay, which, tell me about that.
Which people are hopping on that wagon with force. Now, you can buy alcohol in restaurants and bars and pubs for consumption on site. You can't take it with you, right? You cannot leave the premise with an open bottle of anything. That's illegal. To purchase for the home or to purchase legally, you need to go and buy it from the monopoly. Now, the trick is, and this is just, in layman's terms, the trick is that you are allowed to buy alcohol online. There's no law against that, right? But then you just need a pickup point. Simple. Which means that we have now a budding flora of businesses that have online stores that are based overseas, but the warehouse is local, and so is the pickup point. So there's a lot of drama in the wine world in Iceland these days because of this loophole regulation. So we'll
it's funny you say that, because I remember going to visit a business in Hamburg called Havesco, which is one of Germany's very biggest, you know, wine companies. And they have a wine club that is just for Sweden because of this same loophole. So people can, you know, buy from a, air quote, Swedish wine club and then pick it up. And of course, it does undermine the monopoly.
It does, but I mean, I suppose it depends on how you look at it. I mean, are monopolies still applicable in this day and age? Should there be a loophole there as well? Should there be examples of you know, larger brands and more accessible wines being in the monopoly, while boutiques can open up for the choosy consumer? I mean, who says? Now, I'm neither with or against, because I don't have the opportunity to be political in this case. I represent the Sommeliers Association, and we welcome, you know, all wine, all beverages. And, you know, I kind of have to stay neutral. But where do you draw the line? Who says that this must be a rule, aside from the government that's conflicted about it at the moment, right?
Yeah, I mean, all of the monopolies, I think, were introduced because, you know, there's a very heavy culture of spirits drinking in the cold end of the world, which is perhaps not surprising. And you wonder how much that's still necessary in an age of moderation and wine culture and so on. But that, of course, as you say, is a political question. So I want to go...
It's about taxation.
It is about taxation. And also governments like monopolies, because they don't just get the excise tax, they also get the sale of the alcohol itself. And I think they quite like the revenue. So I want to go back a step to something that you told me late at night in a pub, which is at one point in your life... We're in a wine bar. That at one point in your life, you were a grave digger. I want to hear all about that. How did you get into grave digging? Tell me the ins and outs of that.
So it sounds more macabre than it actually was. In my late teens, technically I wasn't old enough for people to want to, you know, hire me. And I needed a job. I was a dishwasher all over town. I used to work in bars. It's not the only places that would hire teenagers at the time. It was a while ago. But as far as a day job, I worked for a company that was responsible for as caretakers for graveyards. And I mean, there are some lovely graveyards in this country. They're beautiful, the cemeteries.
I'm sure there are.
They need upkeep. But, you know, sometimes you kind of just need to dig a hole because, you know, somebody's time was up. So a big part of it was, you know, taking care of the flower beds and trimming the trees. But for the couple of summers that I was there, there was movement. And so I had my little step stool and I had my big shovel and I just had to get to work.
Because I'm really surprised that they weren't dug out by, you know, machinery, because I imagine, you know,
They are in general.
Right.
But in the really old part of the older cemeteries, you can't get the machines in there. So you send a teenage girl instead.
Good grief. And did somebody train you on how to dig the proper grave size and get the walls all smooth? Like, how much training did you have?
Yeah. I wouldn't say training, but it was more like someone standing half a meter above me. No. You need nice straight corners, 90 degrees. You know, you mark them out with string, basically, and then you just start digging down.
So did some poor person get buried in your first wonky effort that didn't have proper straight walls?
I never participated in anything unless I can do it well. So I made sure those walls were solid straight. It was harder to do it in the rain because it gets all, you know, squishy and muddy. Tourists found it riveting. I don't know how many times I was stuck in one of those things and, you know, old German tourists come up and start taking photos. It's really weird.
No, I would be taking photographs as well, Alba. That would be me. I would be like, what's that teenage girl doing?
I'm so happy that you said it out loud because I was about to call you out.
I was like, that would be great. Did you end up with like fantastically muscular arms?
I was pretty good to begin with. So, you know, but everything can be added.
Yeah, you must have been like a machine by the time you finished that job.
Totally. I mean, it was but it was also really satisfying, actually, because you get to spend time, you know, outdoors in the sunshine during the summer. We have 9 months of darkness here. So anything to do with nature and using your hands and fresh air, it really is quite the gift. So I was into it.
Yeah.
And then I'd, you know, finish up, get cleaned up and go to the restaurant and wash dishes.
Do you ever go past people digging holes and think, that's not very professional? That's not how I would do it.
I would usually stop and wonder whether I should ask them, is it just the entire hole or are you just digging half a hole?
So you've got a professional view of hole digging now.
is that half a hole? No.
Actually, there's something I should probably ask about, the intense darkness. How does that affect drinking culture?
Heavily. It really does. Most of us will try and keep up with our vitamin D supplements because it really is important. The darkness does have quite the effect on your psyche. And usually you wake up, it's dark. You go to work or you go to school, it's dark. You come home, it's dark. And at the end of the day, it's like, meh, let's just go to the pub. We will light our Christmas lights early and we won't bring them down until March because it just lights up the sky. So it's intense.
So as I'm speaking to you in the early Christmas period, so it's already dark.
Well, I'm at the moment, it's about 11 o'clock in the morning. So the sun is attempting to creep. It's still rising, but it's light out. But at around 3:34-ish, it's gonna start dipping again. Come January, February, it's gonna be solid black.
And what does that do to people psychologically? Does everybody suddenly get really grumpy? Do they get really depressive, or do they get more social and outgoing?
One does not negate the other. So you do get heavier in your heart. And a way to combat that is to socialize more. See people, see your family, see your friends, go out, do something. Don't just sit at home and rot like a mushroom. It's important.
Maybe as you speak, I can understand the monopoly a bit better because the combination of alcohol and darkness and people being alone and depressed must be quite a toxic combination.
It is. And that's why moderate consumption is so important and for us who do work in the industry to lead by example.
Yeah, all right. Now, how does your family come to be in Iceland in the first place? Tell me that story.
So my mother married an Icelander when I was a child. So we
and where's your mother from?
In 1988. We're from Singapore.
Right.
So I was almost six when we moved here. But I was fortunate because I'm at that age where I'm still a bit of a sponge when it comes to languages. So I am a native speaker of both Icelandic and English. It was just that lucky little window there. But, I mean, yes, we're far away from everything. And, I mean, Singapore is literally on the other side of the planet.
And it's tropical.
And it's tropical, right? It could not be more of a polar opposite than it is. But living in a country that has such a small population that is so isolated and technically we have almost no industry here. So even if we have 9 months of darkness and the weather can be a bit shitty, it is a very small price to pay for fresh air and the cleanest water on the planet.
But how did your mother cope with? I mean, that is beyond a culture shock. That would be like moving to Mars.
I mean, it was intense. It was intense. I mean, back in 1988, nobody had seen an Indian person in their life. So I'm, because I'm mixed. My father's Australian, and my mother is Indian, Singaporean Indian, right? So we're Tamil. So I'm the only white creature in my family. Everybody is these lovely shades of chocolate, and I just like popped out like a vanilla swirl or something.
Yes, but a very lovely looking one, Alba.
Thank you. It helps. But because I burn in the sun. It's pathetic, actually. My skin strips.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking to me who, you know, I just go out in winter sunshine and I vanish like a vampire.
I feel you. I feel you, sister. but yeah, it was intense, the culture shock here, because people had never seen a person of any other color than anemic Caucasian before, right? So it took quite a while. Today it's completely different. It's a completely different atmosphere. We have lovely crayons in the box, but we're still a very small country. But I mean, out of these 370,000, we maybe have a rough estimate of 20,000 to 30,000 that are imported products, like wine,
imported products,
like myself.
And you've mentioned in the past that it was your mother that taught you to smell and taste. Can you talk about that?
So my mother's a chef, and she deals with Southeast Asian cuisine, which was crucial when actually we moved here, because, I mean, it's one thing to come from Southeast Asia in the tropics with everything that is available there to a country that hardly grows a tomato, right? So she would have curry leaves, chilies and everything just sent in from her friends in Milan and from Denmark just so she could cook. I mean, the woman just got hungry. But she did teach me how to taste, because she'd just play a game with me when she was cooking, where I'm just growing up, is that she would make me close my eyes and I would have to guess by smelling it or tasting it what she had in her hand. And sometimes it would be, you know, chocolate, or sometimes it would be, you know, curry leaf. Sometimes it would be chili, because that was funny, apparently. But years and years of that, you learn a certain technique of blind tasting, per se. It's just, you know, 'cause anyone can do it. And as you know yourself, it's just a trick. It's a matter of training. Anyone can blind taste. It's just how you're focusing it, right?
Yes, I remember reading the wonderful biography of Robert Parker by Ellen McCoy, and in that she describes the way he trained himself to smell, that he would consciously, everywhere he was walking, he would be like, what tree is this I'm smelling? Is this asphalt? Is, you know, what is the rain doing? That just that constant focus on the sensory details. And so the next question, of course, is what was your father as an Australian doing in Iceland?
No. My mother married an Icelander.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Oh, okay. We'll get to the Australian part of the story in a second. All right. So you already existed, and your mum married an Icelander, and that's how you went.
Correct. Yeah.
All right. So now let's talk about the interesting bit about how you tracked down your father.
That was so strange, actually. So I had lost contact with him when I was just a child, because he was an engineer and he was working all over Southeast Asia. So, you know, whatever, you know, letters were sent, they were all coming back, and it was impossible to go through the embassies. And it was because I wasn't of age, right? So my mother couldn't do anything legally, because I'm the child and I wasn't of age. But, I mean, then after a while, I just thought that the man had simply just passed away, right? Anyway, fast forward to 2008, 2009, when Facebook is just popping up. And at the time, you know, there were all these random little games that you could play on Facebook, like which superhero are you, and so on. And I don't think it's a surprise to anybody that I am Batman.
I am surprised.
No, I'm definitely Batman. But at the time, you'd have like random people in the world pop up, you know, who took the same tests and something like that. And I remember it so well, because I just come home from a long shift. It was like 3 a.m. I'm sitting there, you know, just trying to wind down after service, and I'm playing this game. And one of these names pops up on my screen, and I'm like, because I knew that I had sisters, and I knew two of their names, and it was one of those names that popped up, and I was like, how strange. So at 3 a.m. with all your logic that's functioning at that moment, I sent her a message that, hi, so sorry to bother you, but your father wouldn't happen to be so-and-so. It would be a funny coincidence. And I get an answer the day after, because, I mean, this is obviously in Australia, there's the time difference. The day after, I get an answer. Who wants to know? I'm like, me? And the rest is history. He contacted me. I went to Australia. And I gained sisters. So that was a win all around.
That's an extraordinary story. Can I ask you anything more about it, or is this an off-limits topic?
I mean, it's not really an off-limits topic. You know, I suppose it depends on who's listening.
What is it like to meet people that you're very closely related to, but they're also strangers?
Oh, it was amazing. Well, I mean, so we had kept contact for a little bit before I actually went to Australia, so I did get to know them a little bit. But there are many of us. My father was a dude.
Apparently so. When you say there are many of us, can you count the number?
I think we're 9 and counting.
Oh, okay. Your dad was a dude. Oh, goodness.
I mean, he was tall and beautiful and blue-eyed in Southeast Asia. All of us have mothers who are models or some sort of catch. It was intense, and we're all mixed. Well, most of us at least. It was a thing, but it was really a win in life. They are some of the best people I know, some of the cleverest people I've ever met.
When you meet people that, like I said, you're closely related to, but you're also a stranger, is there a shock of recognition? You know, is there a sort of instant, you know, do you find that you've got the same mannerisms, you do things the same way?
So I'm told, actually, apparently, according to my sisters, I have a tendency to sound like him, which isn't great, actually, if you think about it. Sounding like my father, who was the poster child of the right-wing Caucasian straight man. You can just imagine. But no, there are similarities that you would never have expected. Never at all. And again, we didn't grow up together. We hardly knew each other, but you can pinpoint certain things, you know.
What an extraordinary story. All right, so fast forwarding back to your life now, how do you see the Smellier Association, the wine landscape? What do you see ahead in Iceland?
Well, I see this just a growing entity, because again, we're so new to the game. So, for instance, that basic idea, like what is the difference between the concept of old world in wine production versus new world in wine production? And the easiest way that I have to explain it to people is that the new world per se has been producing for hundreds of years, while the old has been producing for thousands. In our case, beer was legal in 1989. We have a lot of catching up to do. So it is budding, but it's evolving quite fast. And people do appreciate the beverage or beverages for what they are and how to consume them. And I mean, the sky's the limit, but it's just going to take a little time because there aren't many of us.
No. All right. Well, on that note, thank you so much for your time this morning, Albert.
Thank you for having me, Felicity. And let me tell some strange stories about horrible food and grave digging. It's weird.
Yeah, that's right. Pissing on fish.
Thanks, pissing Albert. On fish.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.